From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Stephen Quayle joins us on breaking world news and events. Here's what's happening. Global health experts at the World Health Organization, they're meeting to discuss new measures to tackle the Ebola outbreak. The meeting is expected to last 2 days and will decide whether to declare a global health emergency. On Wednesday, a man suspected to have contracted Ebola died in Saudi Arabia. If confirmed, this will be the first Ebola-related death outside of Africa. The virus has killed nearly 900 people since February in West Africa. And now that Dr. Kent Brentley and Nancy Reitbol are in isolation at Emory University Hospital, the CDC's attention now is turned to a more pressing problem from Ebola. They are now concerned about people traveling to the United States from West African countries. The CDC is alerting health departments and hospitals across the country to be hypervigilant, watching for potential exposure to Ebola in any person who has traveled from Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria in the past 21 days. And in a moment, Steve Quayle will talk with us about that. A Japanese scientist involved in a scandal over discredited stem cell research has been found dead at his laboratory in an apparent suicide. He was cleared of any direct misconduct by the investigation, but faced criticism for his oversight. Scientists around the world have expressed regret at losing a renowned researcher and concern at the witch hunt that followed the revelations. Hawaiians are stocking up on supplies as twin hurricanes barrel toward the Pacific Island U.S. state, threatening heavy winds and flash flooding. Hurricane Isa was 925 miles east of Honolulu, expected to make landfall as early as Thursday. Hurricane Julio could arrive in Hawaii 2 days later. The last cyclone to hit Hawaii back in 1992 killed six, cost $2.4 billion in damage. Let's check in with Mitch Batras, earthchangesmedia.com. Double hurricanes or high storms. That's unbelievable, Mitch.
Well, let's hope it doesn't end up like the previous event. And if the hurricanes continue their trajectory, it may not be as bad. Now, remember, the first hurricane began just on Monday with a Category 4. So it's going the right way. It's now dropped to a Category 1, which is still very, very dangerous, especially when you have such unsettled water and air with one coming right behind the other. So it really has some potential to cause some problems. But the good news is, at this point, they do appear to be diminishing, but you can never tell. There is one new bit of research that is starting to change the way they predict the hurricane season. However, NOAA, at least at this time, is continuing to predict a below-average hurricane season for the Atlantic. And they're saying that it's the development of El Nino, which is the cause. When you get into El Nino, again, we're talking about jet streams and water currents. Here's the new piece that they're now placing on these predictions, which I think is going to change the prediction for 2014, and that is the heating of the oceans. Mm. If you look at the trajectory of these hurricanes, remember just 3 days ago there were five hurricanes all traveling in the same area. If you look at their patterns, it is going right over what's called undersea volcanoes, undersea rifts, and these mantle plumes.
So as they heat up, Mitch, they create this current, this turbulence, goes into the atmosphere, and look what's happening. Track Mitch by going to earthchangesmedia.com. Well, the latest is legitimately a scary story. Maybe. Russian hackers, as I reported yesterday, apparently stole 1.2 billion unique usernames and password combinations. Now, that's nearly the population of China, and more than 500 million email addresses, according to a New York Times story published late Tuesday. The firm that uncovered the breach Hold Security of Milwaukee said a group of about 20 hackers from South Central Russia are to blame. The group, dubbed Cybervor, meaning thief in Russian, stole data from thousands of business websites, both small and large, and even from personal websites. Or did they? Let's check in with the expert, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, there's a little question here, isn't there?
Yeah, we've talked about, you know, these various password theft stories before, and they usually follow a regular pattern. I mean, we know who they were stolen from. There's warnings to change your password. We know what kinds of passwords they were, you know, whether they were old or new, whether they were hashed or in the clear, all these different kinds of things that are important to know. We don't have any of that on this one. That company that announced this and is the sole source for this story from that went to the New York Times and then blew up everywhere after that has released to the public or to the companies that are supposedly involved apparently no information at all. And in fact, at one point, The company was apparently implying, at least according to some reports, that they wanted people to pay to find out if their passwords and email addresses were on this list. This is very, very unusual.
It sure is.
And so at this stage of the game, I don't think there's really any there's no reason to panic because there's nothing you can do because you don't really know what's happened, if anything. The biggest problem is if you don't know what these things are, you don't know whether they were, you know, there's caches of very old passwords that are floating around the Internet.
Sure.
And over time, those build up. You wonder how you get to a 1.2 billion. Well, you know, if you have 5 years worth of passwords, it becomes easier to understand. So while people need to be, you know, vigilant as always, until we get more information about this in terms of the technical details to be able to really understand what has happened here and how important it really is, and until this company becomes more forthright about releasing the kind of information that companies need to know and that people need to know about this, don't panic. Just pay attention to your accounts, pay attention to what's going on, and of course, listen to the news and see if we get more information.
All right, Lauren, thanks so much. And just as Lauren said, watch your accounts, see if there's anything strange. Taking aspirin every day can reduce the chance of developing or dying from bowel and stomach cancers. According to a review of all available evidence, scientists predict that if anybody aged 50 or above took aspirin or takes it for 10 years, some 122,000 deaths could be prevented over just a couple decades. After a 10-year chase taking it billions of miles across the solar system, the Rosetta spacecraft has made history as it became the first probe to rendezvous with a comet on its journey around the sun. Robert Zimmerman, space historian and the one who founded BehindTheBlack.com, the website. This is exciting, Robert.
Oh, man. George, for the last week and a half, I've been posting every day images as this thing gets closer because it's been truly, truly cool. You can't get cooler than this. And what we're seeing is something that looks completely different than any object we've seen before. It doesn't look like an asteroid. It has almost no craters on it. The analogy I did on Behind the Black is, remember the theory that comets are dirty snowballs?
That's right.
Actually? Well, that's what it is. And the analogy I've got is if you live in a city where they have plows and in the wintertime a big snowfall comes along, the snowplow will push it to the side and you'll get a big mound of snow, which after a period of time gets covered with soot and grime from the city. And then it starts to melt. Well, that's exactly what this looks like, and that's exactly what it is, essentially. I mean, there's a lot more details to it, but that's what it looks like. It's very cool. It's a pile of snow, dirty snow, that's slowly evaporating away, and Rosetta is now going to follow it as it moves into the sun and goes around the sun over the next year and a half, and they've got a lander. They're going to land on it in November. You can't get more exciting.
I just love the way technology, when it works, Robert, it's amazing, isn't it?
You know, George, this is just, it's breathtaking. And once again, the best image they posted so far is one that looks down, this duck-like object. It's two pieces that are like stuck together,
yeah.
A smaller and a bigger. And the best image they got from yesterday when they made rendezvous was down the two objects, and you can see, it's like looking down a mountain. It's just, you can't beat this.
Track Robert's work at BehindTheBlack.com. And, of course, images of Rosetta and the comet, you can see at coasttocoastam.com. Here's some facts to ponder. There are as many stars in our galaxy, about 100 billion, as there are neurons in your brain. Your cell phone has more computing power than NASA had when it landed Apollo 11 on the moon. Strange, huh? Up next, the future of the mind, with none other than Michio Kaku on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Michio Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of the string field theory, best-selling author. And we're talking about his latest work, The Future of the Mind. But Michio, always a pleasure to bring you back on the program.
Well, George, always glad to be on.
So much going on in the world and in space. I don't know what to start with. It's exciting, this Rosetta spacecraft. It's amazing, isn't it?
Right. And, you know, realize that this is blazing the trail for humans landing on an asteroid. Realize that President Barack Obama has canceled the space shuttle, canceled the mission to Mars and the mission to Moon. However, he left the door open for one day sending a manned mission to land on an asteroid. And the Rosetta mission could be a stepping stone in that direction, because the Rosetta mission has essentially rendezvoused with a comet between Mars and Jupiter. And it could be basically a test trial of the dynamics of what's necessary to land on a moving celestial body.
The mathematics involved, Michio, in creating that exact landing has got to be unbelievable.
That's right. And we can thank Isaac Newton. It turns out that Isaac Newton's laws, written down several hundred years ago, are the exact laws that we use to hit a score of bullseye, basically a bullseye with a comet billions of miles out in outer space. That's how accurate Newton's laws of motion are. Newton, of course, didn't have computers or space probes. Now that we do, we can use his basic equations to score a bullseye in outer space between Mars and Jupiter. A 10-year journey from 2004 to 2014 to score a rendezvous with a comet.
I've got to tell you, wherever I go, people always bring you up. They say, what's he like? What's he like? He loves science, doesn't he? I said, yeah, he sure does. What's new with you, Michio?
Well, of course, I've been on a book tour for The Future of the Mind. I've had several New York Times bestsellers, but this is the first one that hit number one on the
Good
New York Times
you.
Bestseller list, and I'm sure the George Norrie Show has something to do with that.
And you know what? We're not even finished. Watch as it keeps going up, up, up and away. That's exciting. It really is.
Yeah.
For you, all the things you've done with space, I mean, you're looking at dark matter now. You're looking at string field theory that you were the co-founder. We're finding more and more planets. What for you, Michio, is the most exciting aspect of the universe? Or can you pinpoint one?
Well, the very fact that we have the Large Hadron Collider, you know, outside Geneva, Switzerland,
yeah,
capable of creating forms of matter that we've never seen before, new forms of matter like the Higgs boson, points the way to what Einstein believed is lurking in the distance, the Holy Grail of science, which is the theory of everything. And so we think that the Higgs boson is nothing but a piece of the puzzle. And beyond that, we hope to find sparticles. That's the next thing we hope to find, super particles, that is higher vibrations, higher musical notes of a tiny vibrating string. And that could open up the floodgates. Because how many musical notes are there on a violin string? Infinite number, which means there could be an infinite number of subatomic particles. And so this could be the story of the Big Bang, because as we go earlier and earlier, we realize that these particles determine the nature and the structure of Genesis itself. And so we're beginning to probe the ultimate nature of the universe. This is incredible.
You know, and the fact that we're beginning to understand these things, let's jump ahead 10 or 20 years with this growth of knowledge. We may change everything we're learning today, wouldn't we?
That's right. You realize that all the textbooks are being rewritten even as we speak. All the high school textbooks used to say that the universe is made mainly out of atoms, that the universe is expanding but slowing down. Well, both statements are wrong. and all the textbooks are being rewritten. We now know that visible matter only makes up maybe 4% of the universe. 23% is made of dark matter, which is invisible. And 73% of the universe, the lion's share, is dark energy. The energy of the Big Bang itself that is pushing the galaxies apart. And so all the textbooks were wrong. And then the universe is not slowing down at all. It's speeding up. And that caught a lot of people by surprise.
And the
sad thing is we don't know why. And so, you know, poets ask the question, will the universe die in fire or ice? Right now, it seems to be tilting toward ice, that the universe is going to expand, careen out of control and expand to the point where it gets awfully cold out there. But we're not sure about this because we don't know what's driving this accelerated expansion. And so we have so many question marks that have to be answered. And so this is like the golden age of cosmology. We're entering an era that we never thought even existed. And now we realize there's a whole shelf full of Nobel Prizes waiting for the person who can figure out these puzzles.
Are new solar systems, new planets being formed still all the time?
That's right. And with the Kepler satellite, which unfortunately is crippled right now, we're beginning to document and create an encyclopedia of roughly 2,000 exoplanets that are orbiting other stars. And what's exciting is for the first time in history, we can now do a census of our own backyard, the Milky Way galaxy. We now realize that on average, every star in the galaxy has a planet going around it. One-to-one. On average, every star we see at night has a planet going around it. And one in five probably has an Earth-like planet going around it. And this is incredible, one in five. It means that we can now do a census of the galaxy itself. There are billions of Earth-like planets out there in outer space. And so when you look at the night sky, realize that somebody is probably looking back at you.
Well, there's no question about that. And NASA, you know, just a month or so ago, announced that within 20 years, hopefully, we may find life. Now, I happen to think we'll find it much sooner than that, but I thought that was an exciting remark.
Yeah, that's a sea change because, you know, astronomers are very cautious. They have their scientific reputations at stake, and so they very rarely stick their neck out making predictions. But this is a stunning prediction because it means that perhaps in the lifetime of many people that hear this conversation, we're going to make first contact with an intelligent life form in outer space. This is stunning news.
You've always said that we are lower on the pecking order as a civilization, as a planet. When do you think we will start to elevate?
Well, I think in 100 years. If you just get a calculator and calculate when the next transition in civilization will be, it'll be in about 100 years. We'll make the transition to, you know, what is called type 1 civilization, a planetary civilization, a civilization that harnesses all planetary energy. For example, they'll be able to modify or change the weather. They'll be able to play with the oceans, things that planetary they'll be able to control. And we see the beginnings of it right before our eyes, the Internet. You know, the Internet is the beginning of a type 1 telephone system. So we're privileged to be alive to see the beginning of the first major type 1 telephone system, the Internet.
And how high up can you get, Michio, in terms of this elevation?
Well, that's a big debate. Type 3 is what we usually associate with what we can physically measure. Type 2, for example, would be stellar. So that stars that can be manipulated, like in Star Trek, the Federation of Planets of Captain Kirk would be a Type 2 civilization. Then there's Type 3, you know, civilizations that roam the galactic space lanes, like in Star Wars. So Star Wars would be an example of a Type 3 civilization. But then there's speculation of Type 4. Now, Type 4 mm-hmm. would have to be extragalactic. That is harnessing an energy supply beyond the Milky Way galaxy. Now, we used to think there was no such thing, okay? End of story, there is no such thing as type 4. However, we now realize that there is something that could be type 4, dark energy.
Dark energy is extragalactic. That is, it's actually pushing the galaxies apart. And on Star Trek, if you're a Star Trek fan, the Q would be an example of an extragalactic civilization, a civilization that moves between galaxies, that harnesses intergalactic power. So we even have a candidate for what a Type 4 civilization may look like. And at that point, some people think that a Type 4 being would be indistinguishable from a god.
Well, you may very well be right there. When we come back, we'll talk about Parallel Universes, his latest work, of course, The Future of the Mind, and also time travel, just ahead on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, and we're very fortunate to have Michio Kaku with us for a couple hours tonight as we talk about his latest work, The Future of the Mind, which we will get into in a moment. Michio, if you could explain for us inflation, and to those people out there saying, what am I, he's not an economist. Oh, no, we're talking about something different. Inflation, how does that equate to what's going on in the universe?
Right. Well, see, the idea of parallel universes is so fantastic that people sometimes say, ha, there's no experiment. There's no experiment that you can do to prove there are other parallel universes out there. However, there is. Just a few months ago in the South Pole, they picked up gravity waves, vibrations, gravity vibrations from the instant of the creation of the universe itself. And that's predicted by inflation theory. Inflation theory is a modification of the Big Bang. It shows that the Big Bang was much more ferocious, much more turbocharged than previously thought. And this tiny little thing the size of an atom blossomed into the entire universe in just a fraction of a second. Now, it turns out that inflation is a quantum theory, meaning that there's a probability that it could happen again and again and again. And if Big Bangs happen all the time, then our universe could be sprouting baby universes all the time. So if our universe is like a soap bubble, and the soap bubble is expanding, then perhaps there could be other soap bubbles out there. And these soap bubbles could then peel off baby bubbles. And so we have a bubble bath of universes. And so this sounds crazy, but it is now the dominant theory in cosmology. You could go to any cosmology conference on the planet Earth, talk to them about inflation, about the multiverse, and they'll say, yeah, it is the leading candidate now for a theory of the Big Bang itself. In fact, my friend Alan Guth of MIT, who proposed inflation theory, may very well win the Nobel Prize for it.
Now, like soap bubbles in a bathtub, which all stick together, are these bubbles in the that are universes, are they stuck together, or are they basically hanging out there separately in this dark matter of a universe, a bigger universe?
For the most part, these are bubbles floating by themselves in a much larger arena. Now, our bubble is three-dimensional. You know that because you simply look outside the door.
That's right.
You have length, width, and height. And so our bubble must be floating in a higher dimension. In fact, string theory predicts that it is 11-dimensional. And so we have this 11-dimensional nothing out of which bubbles are freely floating, and these bubbles can bump into each other, or these bubbles can peel off baby bubbles. And that's the new paradigm that's emerging from experimental data coming from the South Pole. And it shows that our universe may not be alone, that there could be other universes out there. And again, you know, a lot of people at this point would say, well, is Elvis Presley still alive in another parallel universe? You can't rule it out. It can't be ruled out.
If that's possible, if there's another Elvis Presley, or there's a Michio Kaku, or there's a George Norrie, does that tell you that it has something to do with quantum and time? Or is it just something where the formula may be the same, and so you're going to get the same thing?
Well, it turns out that if there is a multiverse, for the most part, most universes are probably not very interesting. Most of the universes may be dead universes. That is, protons are not stable, atoms decay,
And so you have an ocean of electrons, which is not very interesting at all. No stable matter, no atoms. However, in a handful of these universes, they could be very similar to our universe. And so, yes, there could be another George Norrie out there who is a pro wrestler rather than a talk show host.
I'd be losing like crazy, probably. Getting
George
slammed to the mattress.
Running for the presidency of the United States. Your mind goes swimming thinking about these things, but these are all compatible with the laws of physics. And now with this new sensational data coming from the South Pole, it seems to be compatible with experimental data as well.
That is amazing. I'm not getting a lot of physicists, Mathieu, jumping on the time travel is possible bandwagon. It's kind of disappointing. I thought we'd get more scientists say time travel will be possible. We'll go into the future. We could go into the past. They're basically saying we can't go into the past and the future will be minimal. What's up with that?
Well, it turns out that if you simply look at the special theory of relativity, that is the theory of 1905, that theory, of course, gives us the atomic bomb. And it gives us the fact that time can slow down. It shows that every astronaut is a time traveler. Every astronaut going into outer space actually goes forward in time a few billionths of a second, which is not much. However, if you could go near the speed of light, which we hope to do perhaps by the end of this century, then you can make time almost stop, in which case you could leapfrog into the future. So going into the future is something that's, you know, well established. We do believe that we'll have starships within 100, 200 years from now, and they'll be able to go into the future. However, going into the past is controversial because there's something called causality, you know, cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you go back to the past and commit suicide in the past? You shoot yourself before you shoot yourself as a child. How could you grow up to be yourself if you just shot yourself as a child? And so you have all these paradoxes coming into play. And that's one reason why some physicists are a little bit skeptical, like, for example, Stephen Hawking. However, there's a loophole, and that's the quantum theory, meaning that time is a river. A river that can fork into two quantum times. That quantum time can actually be like a river that forks into two rivers. And so when you go back into the past and meet your teenage mother before you're born and she falls in love with you, that's not really your teenage mother. It looks like your teenage mother. She talks like your teenage mother. But you're in a parallel universe. And so your timeline splits in half. And what you're doing is you're going backwards in time in somebody else's timeline. So there are no paradoxes whatsoever if you believe in quantum time. That is, the river of time can fork into parallel universes, in which case when you go backwards in time, you monkey with somebody else's universe that looks just like your universe, but it's not.
Is the quantum movement of time, is it almost like it's been recorded on videotape, in that whatever has happened in the past, whether it was witnessing the crucifixion of Jesus or World War II, that somewhere out there in quantum, it's there?
Well, that's more the Einstein non-quantum point of view. Einstein believed that the future was totally predictable, that if you have sufficient computer power, you could predict the future. And so reality is like a motion picture. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's all finished. Somebody hit the play button, and we're nothing but dancing figures inside a movie that's already been scripted and filmed. And we're simply, we think we have free will, but actually we're just like Cary Grant in an old movie that was filmed decades ago. That's the Einstein picture. However, the quantum picture is much more bizarre. The quantum picture says that every juncture, the river of time can fork, and you have many endings. You have many probable beginnings, middle, and ends. There is no one movie that has your past, present, and future on it.
Is our future already predetermined, or can we change?
Well, according to this new picture, the quantum picture, the future is not determined, and we have free will,
and that it's a matter of probability which future is revealed to us. And this is not the Newtonian or Einsteinian theory where the reality is nothing but a motion picture that's already been filmed and, you know, somebody hit the play button. Here we have many play buttons and we have many possibilities and we have many possible parallel universes. And that is borne out in electronics. The very fact that we have laser beams, the very fact that we have transistors, the very fact that we have this phone conversation defies common sense. How is it possible that a laser beam can exist? Newton would say that a laser beam is impossible. Laser beams are possible because it's a quantum device, and the same thing with transistors. Modern electronics depends upon the quantum theory. If you turn off the quantum theory, all modern electronics falls apart, and we're thrown back 100 years into the past. And so the quantum theory is definitely correct, but its philosophical consequences are bizarre and absolutely incredible.
We're with the theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. His new work, The Future of the Mind, a bestseller on the New York Times list. And this incredible work tells us all kinds of things, including something I've always been fascinated with, that is uploading memories. As a matter of fact, Michio, Ted Williams used to be a great baseball player in his day. When he died, his family has cryogenically kept his head because they hope to clone him, but more importantly, what they want to do, as you talk about in your book, The Future of the Mind, is upload his memory into the new clone Ted Williams' body. Unbelievable.
Well, it's something we can talk about. We have the Human Genome Project, by which we can, in some sense, bring Ted Williams back to life as a young boy, by cloning him, but we also have the Connectome Project, by which we can map all the neural pathways of the mind and bring back memories and sensations and emotions. And so in the future, not the distant future, but in the near future, we'll have two disks. One disk is the genome, by which we can bring back our body, and the other is the connectome, by which we'll be able to bring back our mind. And you put them together, and what do you get? Immortality.
Immortality. You live forever.
That's right.
Because we basically are our mind. I mean, that's, you know, we have our legs and our arms and we're doing our thing, but it's the mind that creates who we are.
And that's right. Our personality, our whims, everything. Our desires.
So if you can move that around, you probably wouldn't even need the same cloned person you were. You could put it in any kind of a cloned body.
In principle, yes, you could put yourself into what is called a surrogate, that is an artificial body like a robot, and come out as Superman or come out with a superhuman body. And so, you know, all these things are once considered science fiction, but now, hey, we're taking these scenarios very seriously because in the coming decades, a lot of these ideas are now physically possible.
Mitchell, what would be my living hell would be if they downloaded memory into the computer and it was active? And it stayed in there. So you had no body, but you were merely in a computer. You're very alert. You could, you know, basically see things that were going on around you, but that's it. You couldn't go anywhere. I'd go absolutely crazy.
Yeah, that's why in my book, I actually mention the possibility that once we have the connectome, instead of spending the rest of our lives stuck in a computer, we could then be put into a surrogate. Now, in Japan, they made the first experiments on surrogates, that is, robots that are controlled mentally by a worker with a helmet. And so I have a picture of a worker from the Honda Corporation putting on a helmet. He communicates by radio mentally to Asimo, which is one of the world's most advanced robots. And so you can actually control the movements. Now, think about it. This could be the future of the space program. We could have astronauts on the moon mentally controlled by an astronaut sitting in his hot tub in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And so this could also be the future, like I mentioned, of the connectome, that if we have the connectome, instead of living your life inside a computer, which is rather boring, why not mentally control a robot with a perfect body? You would be, in some sense, Iron Man or Superman, and you'd be able to have sensations and move and jump, and you wouldn't be trapped inside a computer with no body.
Could you imagine what this would do for, let's say, specialized mind gaming, where people could go and, you know, maybe they wanted to be a skydiver today or a scuba diver tomorrow or a soldier in battle. You could basically do that with this, couldn't you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, in the short term, we already have video games that you play mentally.
Mm-hmm.
You put on a headband, and it picks up your brain waves, and it allows you to control the levels of attainment of a video game, and it allows you to calculate scores and win games. Now, that's today. You can imagine of what it would mean tomorrow when you can start to control avatars and control robots. In fact, Bruce Willis starred in a movie called Surrogates, where people preferred to live as a surrogate because they had superhuman qualities, they were handsome, they never aged, and they didn't want to even see their actual bodies again. Their actual bodies were put in pods, and people lived their life as superwomen and supermen.
You'd never have to worry about paying bills or anything, would you?
Yeah, you'd live in a fantasy world where you have fantasy powers, and your body, of course, is decaying inside a pod, getting older every second, but your surrogate would basically live on forever. Huh. And as I mentioned, that's a possible scenario for the space program.
Yeah.
Outer space is very expensive, and it's very dangerous. Astronauts have lost their lives in outer space. So why not send surrogates controlled mentally by people on the planet Earth? You could then basically control a moon station. A moon station would be very cheap as a consequence. You wouldn't need life support.
That's amazing.
Robots would operate a permanent moon base, and you wouldn't risk any lives at all. No life support, no oxygen. You wouldn't have to worry about meteorite collisions. They're just robots mentally controlled by humans on the planet Earth.
Michio, how realistic is something like that?
I think it's coming simply because of economics. You know, it costs $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit. You know, to put a pound on the moon costs roughly $100,000 a pound, and to put a pound on Mars costs about $1 million a pound. That's your weight in diamonds to put you on the planet Mars right now. And so I think sheer economics is going to push us in the direction of robotic missions. And robots, of course, are not very smart. That's the reason why we don't have robots exploring the galaxy. But why not? Why not have humans mentally control these robots? They would be just as intelligent as us because they would carry out our wishes. And it would be at a fraction of the cost of a human mission to Mars or to the moon.
And would the person on planet Earth get that feeling that he was on Mars? They'd be connected that way?
Of course, it's going to get better and better. That is the connection between the mind and a machine. The main driving force behind this is the United States Pentagon. The Pentagon realized that there are thousands of wounded warriors from Iraq and Afghanistan with injured spinal cords and arms and legs. And so they've pioneered at Johns Hopkins University a program of putting chips in the brain, which then control mechanical arms and mechanical legs. And they have sensations. And the recent soccer games, the World Cup games, if you saw the opening ceremony, billions of people saw a paralyzed individual, putting on an exoskeleton.
Yeah.
By which his brain controlled mechanically arms and legs, by which he initiated the World Cup games. The exoskeleton was designed at Duke University, and it uses all this technology being funded by the United States Pentagon. And it opens up, first of all, an incredible pathway for people who are paralyzed because of sports injuries, strokes, car accidents, people that are vegetables trapped inside their body. Even Stephen Hawking, my colleague, he's now lost control of his fingertips. He can only blink. And so we physicists hooked him up with a similar device in his right glass. So next time you see him on television, look at his right glass, and you'll see that there's a chip there, an antenna, that picks up his brain waves, and it allows him to control a laptop computer by which he can now communicate with the world. So Stephen Hawking, my colleague, now communicates mentally with the outside world.
We're going to come back in just a moment with Michio Kaku. We're going to take phone calls with him. Plus, we've still got lots to talk about. How about telepathy? And what about Stephen Bassett from the Paradigm Research Group, who said that what he would like to do is have Michio Kaku as our representative if we're ever visited by extraterrestrials, to be the first human to communicate directly with them. Let's get Michio's reaction to that as well. And your phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.